I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. So today my guest is Benjamin Harding. He is pursuing a PhD in industrial and organizational psychology at Clemson University, and he writes articles and books, including the book Slipstream Time Hacking, How to Cheat Time, Live More, and Enhance Happiness. So Ben, you lay out a different sort of philosophy about time than most people have, I think. And so maybe you can tell us what is the gist of that philosophy of time.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the core understandings of psychology research nowadays is that each and every person lives in a perceived reality, mm-hmm. that you and I don't experience any experience the same way. We don't see, even if we're both looking at the same, say, yellow lemon, we don't see the same shade of yellow, even though we can both relate on it. And time is the same way. Time is completely subjective, or at least our experience of time is. Mm. And how I came up with my ideas in slipstream time hacking mostly were studying physics, actually. I watched a lot of Christopher Nolan's movies, the main one being Interstellar. Mm-hmm. And that really got me excited about time dilation and time relativity and how basically, according to astrophysics, the faster planets and things move in outer space, the slower time goes. And that idea is conveyed in the movie Interstellar, when the astronauts, they jump onto one of the planets that's orbiting around a black hole. And I hope that this doesn't go too deep, but basically the idea is that because the planet was moving so fast, for every, I think, 1 hour that they were on that planet, 7 years passed by on Earth. Mm-hmm. And so basically the idea is that the faster you move, the slower time goes. And actually that's one of my favorite quotes by Peter Diamandis. He's an author of both Abundance and Bold. And basically the idea is that the faster you can get towards your goals, the longer you have to live. If it takes you 1 year to achieve a goal that might take me a decade, then you will have an extra 9 years to live. And so how I took that idea and how I try to apply it in my life is I try to really clarify and determine where I want to go in my life, what would be my ideal destination, I guess you could say, or how I want to live my life. And then I figure out what would be the quickest way to get there. Mm-hmm. And if I can figure out how to get to a place that might take the traditional approach 10, 15 years, and if I can figure out how to get there in one, then I've added 14 years of extra life that I might not have been able to live.
Hmm. Yeah. So how did that work out in a practical sense?
Yeah. So I've applied that in several approaches to my life. For example, when I decided I wanted to get into a PhD program, it was March of 2014. Mm-hmm. So that was like a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago. And I decided this is exactly what I want to do. I want to do a PhD in business psychology. Mm. And so I started calling programs and I realized that applications were actually due back in December. Oh. And so I was like, okay, I'm 4 months late, but I don't want to wait until next year to get into the program. I want to figure out how I can get into the program this year. Mm. And so I started just asking different programs if I could come in a more non-traditional way. Usually when you go into a PhD program, you have to be funded by the university. And I just asked several different universities if I could come on as a non-funded student and if I could fund myself. And I was able to get into really one of my like top universities without having to wait an extra year. Another story is when I started writing. So I started blogging about 8 months ago. And I was really trying to figure out how to get a book deal because I wanted to actually get Slipstream Time Hacking published by a traditional publisher. And so I started looking for coaches, mostly literary agents, trying to figure out what the best approach I could take to getting this book published in a traditional way. And I talked to probably 10 or 15 of these literary agents who have coaching programs, and they all said that it could not be done unless I had a platform of probably like, you know, 30,000 subscribers. And that generally takes, at least from their perspective, it takes, you know, up to 4 or 5 years to accomplish that when you're first starting out. And I didn't really like that idea, thinking of the idea of destinations and traditional thinking. And, I was thinking, okay, so this takes 4 or 5 years in a traditional manner, but what could I possibly do to get there in, say, like 4 or 5 months? And so I got an online course on how to publish blog posts on stuff like Huffington Post and just get guest posts. And just started blogging, and I started throwing my articles on medium.com. And within a few months of blogging, so that was back in, I think, May. By July, I had written an article that went really viral on Medium and was quickly at over 5, 10,000 subscribers within 2 months. And it was just kind of like, okay, there are different ways to approach the same challenge. And although most people might say this is how you do it, there are different ways in which you can get there faster. And for me, that slowed my time down. Rather than taking 5 years to get there, I was able to get there in a few months. Although, say my book's not published, I was able to get in a position where I could publish my book if I wanted to. And so that's kind of how I try to apply it, and just looking at time in a different way.
And actually, Medium is how I found your work too. And it's a whole different way of, it's a little bit of like hacking the blogosphere, I suppose, is Medium is sort of a different way of doing it that's come along recently that has sort of juiced up the blogosphere, I think, too.
Oh yeah, Medium's totally, I've heard it's the hottest platform on the internet right now as far as blogging. And I think what's cool about Medium is that if you write something good, it will go viral. Like, a lot of platforms you can put your content on and it just disappears. But with Medium, I think that the audience, the people, they just really push forward. And they want to promote and help people. So it's a really cool place to go if you're starting out.
So what I found is your Secrets to Happiness, 10 specific behaviors. And I will have show notes with your website link and the link to the article, and we won't go through all 10, but I was hoping that we could at least go through like the last three that sort of seemed to fascinate me the most, which was the one was really counterintuitive because it was number 8 is do something every day that terrifies you. So it's like to be happy to get terrified, you know. So maybe you can kind of explain that one and why that would make you happy. And maybe before we even delve into that, we can go over how you define happiness in the first place.
Yeah, that is an amazing question. I definitely don't define happiness as kind of how you feel in the moment. For me, happiness is more my overall state of mind based on the life I'm living. Like, even if I'm having a horribly terrible day, I can generally be happy. Well, there's a book that was really helpful. I don't know if you've heard of it, Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl.
Oh yeah.
The idea is obviously that you can find meaning and that you can choose to be happy in any situation. I definitely don't place my own happiness on my external situation, but more on who I am consistently being and kind of the life that that reflects. And so for me, I'm married, I have 3 foster kids, I'm pursuing my goals, and I'm trying my hardest to live according to my values, my beliefs. And even if things fall short, just in my pursuits or just things fall apart, I choose to be happy because I'm living in congruence with what I believe in. So that's kind of how I perceive happiness.
Well, and just to kind of clarify that a little bit too, happiness as defined isn't really circumstantial. It's kind of like an inner, you find it inside. It's like a contentment or like a sturdy happiness or a joy is kind of, it will transcend your circumstances. Kind of, that's really what you're driving at, right? I mean, it's because, I mean, this is kind of, I have 2 children too, and you can have moods that go, you can be in a happy mood and then in a sad mood, and it can sometimes we can wind up anchoring that to, my boss yelled at me, now I'm unhappy, or I got, something bad happened and now I'm unhappy, but really, you're driving at something a lot more deep and rooted.
Yeah, there's actually two really cool ways that I look at it. One is that if you live based on principles rather than based on your moods, then you're gonna, so one of my favorite quotes is every principle has a promise. And if you live based on your mood, or at least your current, you know, emotional experience, chances are you'll make choices that, you know, like, you know, we all wake up in the morning and often don't want to wake up. But if you live your life based on principles and understand that behind every principle is a promise, you know, if you choose to wake up, if you choose to do what you want to do, you know, then the outcome is happiness. Generally, when you're moving forward and achieving things that you want to work towards, you'll be happy. But there's also a book, and maybe you've come across it. It's called The Happiness Equation. And it highlights all of the scientific findings in the science of happiness and positive psychology. And really what all of the psychological research has found is that you can't really pursue happiness. You know, if you're basing your happiness on your external circumstances, like I'll be happy when I'm successful, you're never going to get there. You know, happiness cannot be directly pursued. Actually, what the science is finding is that success, productivity, you know, positive relationships, those things come from being happy. So happiness actually must come first, and then you can be successful. Then you can be productive. Then you can have happy relationships. And so one of my favorite quotes by Wayne Dyer is that there is no way to happiness. Happiness is the way.
Oh yeah. That's a good one. I'd have to put that away and tuck that away like a squirrel with a nut or something. That's a good one. Well, actually, before we even get to the terrifying, do something terrifying. Have you taken the Myers-Briggs test ever?
I actually, as hilarious as it is, because we create psychological tests for my PhD program, I've never taken Myers-Briggs, I've had several people ask me that in the last week.
Because I'm so curious now, because I've had to think about, because in your article, you write, happy people live in the present. And my Myers-Briggs, now I don't find Myers-Briggs like, you know, 100% airtight, that it does do a good job of showing preferences. But that I know as I've gotten older, I've gotten, for instance, less extroverted, where I used to really thrive on other people's energy and be much more like, yeah, let's go from one party to another. And as I've gotten older, I have more of my smaller circle of friends that I really love to be around. But then, you know, parties tire me out and the energy's too much. And so I'm a little more developing my shadow side in, you know, my second half or whatever of life. And I think that, so I'm not that this would matter to you if you haven't taken it and you don't know, but I'm an ENTP, which is the N is the intuitive and the T is thinking. So if you're an NT, you're very forward thinking and things are in the future and there's prospects and there's options and you're really forward thinking. So the thing I've had to really develop is contentment, is thinking about the present, thinking where I am now, because I'm in my head a lot planning and like, oh boy, what's the next big cool thing? And so I've had to be very careful about things like that because I'm not here, you know, I'm excited about what's next. And so I was kind of curious as for you about your personality of, did you have to learn about happiness because, or were you just sort of always content in the moment and in the present, or did you feel like you were forward thinking, had to pull yourself back?
Yeah, well, so I have taken a personality test called the Kolbe A Index. I don't know if you've heard of that before.
No.
But it's a test that many, you know, entrepreneurs use. And what the test actually found is that I actually spend about 40, I think according to the test, I spend about 42% of my energy in the future. and I only use actually like probably 11% of my energy focusing on the present circumstances, focused on like applying whatever. And so actually, I'm very much living in my own future, but I think one of the things that's helped me is, you know, we live in such a distraction age that, I mean, it just keeps coming back to me more and more, be where you're at. So right now I'm having this conversation with you and I just need to be in this conversation. And when I live in the future, I live towards my goals and my dreams, but then that allows me to live in the present. So when I'm with my wife and my foster kids, like I really challenge myself to not think about my work, but just to fully embrace playing with them and like being with them. And so I think really the best thing you can do is just concentrate and just like learn how to be in the moment. But I still very much live in the future as well.
Yeah, it's one of those things. If your temperament, or if your preference, or your sort of, I guess the way you're wired is sort of geared that way, then that's just going to be your temperament, that you'll have to be cultivate that awareness to be like, oh, that's right, I'm here, and I don't want to miss out on where I actually am. And you're right, the distraction environment that we live in, your phone can always pull you away, or whatever else. And that's, I think you're right about, to be happy, you can't be sort of in a place that doesn't exist, the future. It's not there. Being happy is going to be wherever you actually are. But I jumped ahead of myself. Big surprise.
Well, one thing just to cut you off, that's really funny. That's kind of so a lot of the psychology of research has found that anticipation is actually often more enjoyable than the experience you're looking to have. So like say you have this big dream and this big goal to like, get a book published or like, run a marathon. For most experiences, actually anticipating the moment, planning for the moment is more enjoyable. And so it's actually more fun, say, if you want to like run a marathon and you plan it out like 6 months, you get to enjoy building up to that for 6 months. And generally the experience itself is it's not a letdown, but I mean what's funny is it's just that we actually get generally more joy in anticipation than the experience. It's still good to experience things, but
That's exactly the last one of the last podcasts I did was the exact thing you're talking about. And it was because my husband and I planned a cruise that we saved a year f to do. And it was like this big thing. And the cruise was f fun, and we had never done one. And when you take a cruise in January or February to the Bahamas or something, like, it's short, it's only a couple hundred dollars. So it's not hard for anybody to do it, to save, so it wasn't going to take an entire year. And but planning it out was a ton of fun, and it involved a lot of moving parts to get our kids, someone to watch them, and to, what kind of clothes might we get, and what, where are we going to get our plane tickets. And you're right, it was a mood elevator for months because we were looking forward to it. And the cruise was fine, but it was short-lived. It was really a couple of days, and that's it. So that's so true for me to,
and I think what's kind of cool about that is that you set up your year last year to prepare for a cruise, and so that changed your year. That changed, you guys were getting excited and planning all those things. And how I kind of look at that is that you won the game before you even started playing. You set the game up so that you were gonna go on a cruise at the end of the year, and that changed how you played the game throughout the whole year. And so I think planning and preparing for fun things and big things is cool because it changes how you live in the present.
Yeah, I read your article that you wrote about buying the tickets. You bought tickets, like, to a play in London before you knew how you were going to be able to do it. And it was your article about, if you bought the tickets, and then you could figure out how to do it because you were in all the way. And if you didn't know how you would do it, maybe you would never buy them at all. But if you buy them and the stakes are really high like that, then you will figure out how to do it because you're all the way in. And I think there's a neat like psychological advantage to going in all the way and not giving yourself any exits and ways to weasel out of your goals.
Yeah, I actually call that concept the point of no return. It's this idea that you put yourself in a position where going back is no longer an option. And it's kind of based on the quote that once you make a decision, the universe conspires to make it happen. It's like once you buy the plane tickets, now you have to figure out how to make it happen. If you make big promises to people or I mean, it's the idea of basically overcommitting and putting all your eggs in one basket, like really saying, this is what I'm going to do. I don't necessarily know how I'm going to make it happen. But you start with your why first, and then you make it happen. You figure out how you're going to do it. And I think that's just kind of a more fun way to live life.
I think it's, I don't know if you're, if you, do you listen to Tim Ferriss at all?
Yeah,
And
I
he's,
do.
yeah, I'm kind of a big, I'm a big fan from way back. And he always talks about, like, that the stick works better than the carrot. And if you set yourself up to, like, be sort of like embarrassed, or like, have to give to some organization you really don't like, or give money to some organization you really don't like, or something like that, to lose weight or something, that that actually the stick works better than the carrot in terms of high stakes and making sure you set your goals and get your goals accomplished. And it's kind of hilarious because, you know, you could say, I'm going to lose 20 pounds and give yourself, apparently, like, give yourself $1,000 reward or lose $1,000. And overwhelmingly, people will not want to lose the money, but will fail if they are offered the reward. Like, it's just a really weird thing. And like, instead of, the reward won't work, but the stick will, you know. And it's just a funny
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, they actually call that idea in psychology the endowment effect. And it's the idea that we endow way more value in something we already own. You know, it's like if I own a t-shirt, even though it's only worth like $5, it may be worth more to me because it's my t-shirt. And we don't want to lose things that we have. And so it's like, yeah, you don't want to lose your reputation or say your $1,000. That your $1,000 is worth more than someone else's $1,000.
Oh, yeah, right. That's really funny. And yeah, meanwhile, you're not thinking that getting an extra $1,000 would be pretty nice too, you know. That is really funny. Yeah, I'm having a few people on, they're already recorded, but about cognitive bias and magical thinking, and those are coming up soon on my podcast, because I just find neuroscience and perception, it's just sort of endlessly fascinating, because we put ourselves in all these really weird, irrational situations, and we don't realize our bias, and it's sort of like once you can kind of pick it out, you're like, wow, I kind of do that all the time. I talk to my computer as if it understands me. Oh, okay, what am I doing? You know, why am I doing that?
Yeah.
But yeah, and there's all sorts of things. But to get back to some of the ways that we can do things to make us happier behaviorally, if we do something every day that terrifies us, how do you suppose that that would make us happier in the long run?
I think that really the idea behind that is just, if you're not growing, chances are you aren't happy. You know, I think that a big part of at least how I view happiness is progressing, growing, developing, and that generally involves stepping outside of your current realm of comfort. And so, I mean, I do things all the time. I try on a daily basis to at least kind of, I would say, freak myself out. But I guess what Darren Hardy, the publisher of Success, he wrote something really funny, really useful once. And he basically said that you only need to experience fear or be courageous like 15 seconds a day. You know, all the rest of your day, you can just live normally. But if you spend 15 seconds making that phone call, or publishing that blog, or just doing one small thing a day that most people wouldn't do, over a long enough period of time, that would radically separate you. What I do, just to, you know, I take really cold showers in the morning to kind of freak myself out, and then I try to get comfortable with it, just sitting in the cold shower, or, you know, I don't know. I mean, stuff like just being on this podcast, or publishing your articles, or trying to reach out to, say, a mentor, or trying to make that sale, whatever it is that is outside, you know, having that conversation with your spouse. It's those things that we resist. And if you overanalyze it and get stuck in paralysis by analysis, what's kind of funny is the same way with anticipation. Anticipating a positive event is generally better than the event itself. And anticipating a negative event is also way worse than the actual event. You know, living in fear, the fear itself is way worse than generally the actual experience. And so I guess what I found is that if you feel some fear, or if you feel some form of resistance, the longer you hold off on doing that thing, the more painful it is, because most of it's perceived. And so if you just jump in and just do it. And so I guess just training yourself every day a little bit to grow outside of yourself. And that growth, you know, I think growth and moving forward and achieving and developing as a human being is just fundamental to being happy or experiencing joy.
Yeah. And I think overcoming risk or risking something every day and knowing that you did it is really kind of building up this resiliency that is probably mood elevating, but, you know, because you're getting probably some endorphin kick from that, but also just like, you know, I'm stronger than I thought. And I think that can be empowering too, that the kind of terrifying thing isn't always going to be some kind of a physical risk. It's probably going to normally be an emotional one, but it has probably has a cumulative effect too, if you're doing it every single day.
Yeah. And most of the risks we perceive are generally inflated. Like looking back, you realize that you could have easily mitigated the risks. Or, you know, I compare in a lot of my research, I compare people who want to be entrepreneurs with people who already are entrepreneurs. And I ask them the same questions, you know, what would the worst case scenario be if you started this business? And almost always people who want to start a business, they perceive way worse outcomes, you know, and it's like, they think that, like, you know, everything is going to die in their life, you know, if they fail. Whereas people who are already on the other side, who have already succeeded, they realize that, you know, they have control over the risks they take. And, you know, even if things fall apart, their life isn't over. They're not so attached to these things. And I don't know, I think when you're looking towards growing and doing things you haven't done before, your perception of the risk is generally inflated beyond what it beyond the reality, beyond what's actually safe and beyond what's really going on.
Yeah, usually too, when you talk to people who are, for instance, like serial entrepreneurs or people who are older and wiser, they've failed a number of times and they're not scared of that anymore. They're, you know, when you talk to these people, they're like, yeah, I've failed. And, you know, they're like, I'm still here. You know, you just keep putting one foot in front of the other. And I think maybe when you're younger, the inflation may be larger because you haven't failed as much yet, and every failure looks maybe larger than it would once you've had a few failures under your belt and you realize, oh, I'll withstand it. I'll somehow, even if I have to move into my parents' basement or whatever has to happen, we'll make it, you know. But possibly the less failures you've had, the more the fear is going to be there and be larger too. So
yeah, totally.
The experience. So maybe just get your failures over with and keep moving too. I think you're right that the fear itself, it's like the fear itself is the biggest enemy, not what's on the other side of it, because when you're in the middle of it, you're just trying to get through it. But the anticipation is the real killer. It's the real nerve-wracking part.
It is. It totally is. The experience itself, we can generally adapt to. I mean, we've all gone through hard things. We've all, you know, and some things are quite traumatic. Say you have to deal with the death of a loved one, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, there's some really hard experiences that we're all challenged to face. And some of them in the moment can be quite blunt and quite, you know, I mean, they can be really painful, but we always seem to get through it. And generally, you know, if you're consciously taking on challenges, you know, that's what we're talking about here with, you know, facing your fears, is if you're consciously making your life slightly more difficult in order for growth, then you get used to growing and you get used to learning and being stressed and strained a little bit. And that, I mean, that's how I see how people consciously evolve into someone better than they currently are, is purposefully taking on challenge. That's why me and my wife, you know, took on foster care. I mean, we love these kids, but we like taking on challenges that require us to become something more than we currently are, and challenging us to grow into someone that we would love to be. And so, yeah, I think it's good practice to do.
Now, number 9 in your article is put the important before the urgent. And I thought that was such an excellent point. It's one of those things that I can wind up getting wrong pretty a lot if I'm not careful. And maybe you can go into a little bit of an explanation of what that means.
Yeah, this is honestly one of the most important principles to me. I do a lot of coaching for people, and what I find is almost always the case is that people have lots of things that they want to be doing in their life, whether it's getting healthy, whether it's, you know what I mean, pursuing some form of goal, or, I don't know, reading more. I don't know. People have lots of these types of goals that they can easily put off till tomorrow because they're not urgent. They're these things that, they're not in their email box and they're not their 9-to-5 job. I mean, we all have urgent things. We have bills to pay. We've got relationships to manage, and we've got all sorts of things that can easily weigh on us every single day. And if we don't purposefully carve out time to put those important things first, whether it's, doing your side home-based business or, actually going to the gym or writing in your journal or whatever it is that you feel you've been wanting to do for however long you've been postponing it. So one of the main things I do to people is I challenge them to restructure their whole life. And that's almost what you have to do, is you have to defend the important things from the urgent things. And when you first do that, it's pretty hard because chances are you have a job, you have to be at in the morning, and your life isn't structured in such a way to make those important things your top priority. But over time, you really can. So how I do that is I generally don't answer my e I don't even I have my phone on airplane mode when I go to bed, and I don't turn it off airplane mode, and I don't check my email until after I've, spent at least an hour or two pondering, meditating, spending time with my kids, reading, writing in my journal. Like, those things to me are the important things, and exercising. And then I take a cold shower. And after I've done that, and generally that ritual and spending time with my kids and stuff, usually it's not till like 10, 11 in the morning that I can say, all right, I've put the important things first, which those important things are kind of the 80-20 principle. The important things are the 20% of things that are actually moving your life forward. The 80% of things that we do all day are the just things we have to do. Answer emails, actually, deal with other people's agendas. And so I think it's really focusing on those 20% and making sure to defend that and put that first. Like, I have a lady that I coached the other day, and she really, what was it that she really wanted to do? She's a script writer. She lives in Hollywood, and she wants to write scripts. And one of her main goals for 2016 is to sell a script. And, she's had movies made from her scripts, but she's so bogged down by, her apartment and, I mean, just so many day-to-day things that she hasn't made time for script writing in the past like 2 or 3 years. And she has time to do it, but she just hasn't managed her time or structured her time to make that happen. And so my challenge for her was, and she doesn't have a regular 9-to-5 job, and so I just said, don't look at your email, don't answer your phone calls, don't do anything until noon, or at least until after you've spent an adequate time script writing, because that's what you really want to do. And she wants to get her health in order because she's pretty unhealthy and stuff. And it's like, go to the gym, eat good food, put your health in order, meditate or whatever you need to do, and script write. Do that because that's important to you. And then once you've done that, then you can let the day take care of itself, because at some point or another, things come crashing down.
Yeah, it's really hard to be that disciplined sometimes, and you can wind up thinking like one of two things. Either I'm too important and people will have to get in touch with me, which is just kind of crazy that like you could be that important, because it probably even the president is can say, don't bother me, even can carve out margins, And then, and the other one is, I don't want to disappoint people that I can't be reached or something. But I think that if you don't take care of yourself, nobody else will, So it really is, if you don't have the important stuff figured out, the urgent stuff will always crowd it out. And it does get to be an unhappy situation that you feel. I can see how it would really erode like a general happiness from your life, because you don't ever really have any control.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite quotes is, if you wait for too many tomorrows, you'll find that you've got a lot of empty yesterdays. And it's just this idea that your time does get sucked away from you. The years can start moving quicker and quicker if you don't step back and consciously say, okay, my time is being pulled from me. I'm no longer in control of time. It is in control of me. And that's really where all this comes from. And I think when you first start this, I mean, when I first started, and I started doing stuff like this probably like 7 or 8 years ago, I mean, you really have to start small and just say, you know, because I was doing my undergrad and I was going to work and stuff, and so I just said in the mornings, you know, from like 6 in the morning to 8 in the morning is my time to put the important stuff, so that then I can be in a place where I can actually do the rest of my day from a good place of being. I don't think if you don't, it's not necessarily to be selfish and put yourself first. It's really to put yourself in a position where you can serve well, so that you can actually approach everything you do in a from a higher realm of thought. And so I think it takes time to actually, over time, you know, Stephen Covey talks about in the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. That's where I got this idea. He's got this, you know, graph where he explains that highly productive people spend their time almost exclusively on important things and not on urgent things. But I think over time, you can get good at it to such a degree that almost all of your time is spent on the important, and then you do what you can with the urgent stuff.
And I guess it's just about sort of taking what urgent stuff is and then putting it into a slot where it all gets done, but it gets done in a certain period of time so it doesn't spread across your entire day or something. I mean, how do you wind up prioritizing what, like, essentially you can wind up putting out fires all day long, depending on what your job is and how many obligations you have. And, you know, I'm sure it depends on what sort of job you have and what responsibilities you have, but
I think you have to give yourself a time limit. That's what I told this lady. One thing that she always does is she can't help herself from, like, you know, calling people and getting refunds on like her insurance and stuff like that. And she says oftentimes, because, well, she just said like sometimes she needs, sorry, I'm not really explaining this well, but basically, she gets caught up on the phone a lot trying to get refunds for stuff that, like, she's trying, and she'll say, like, sometimes it'll take 3 days that it'll get sucked into, like, losing $70.
Oh,
And so,
yeah.
what I just told her is you have to give yourself a time limit on this urgent stuff. If you don't get your money back in 1 hour, see it as a sunk cost. I mean, for me, a lot of the urgent stuff is like my homework assignments, because, you know, for me, it is more important to me to be blogging and to be learning and stuff. And although I want to spend time on my schoolwork, most of my assignments are kind of just busy work. And so for me, I see those things as urgent activities that just keep popping up. And so I just give myself, I say, I've got 2 hours to do this assignment. Once those 2 hours are done, it's done. I'm going to turn it in as it is, because this is not something that's extremely important to me. It's just an urgent thing.
Yeah, I see what you mean. And putting the right priority on the right thing. It's true that that's got to be a developed skill. If you don't have it, you might have to work for a while on developing that skill, I think. Well, does that play into the 10th one for forgo the good to pursue the best, or is there a different twist on the last one?
I think a lot of it is. I think that some things in life are good, some things are better, and some things are best. And I think that, you know, you have to determine that for yourself based on your own values, priorities, and belief system. For me, you know, for me, family is something that's very important to me. My family, I would put that in the best category for my own values. And so, you know, I stop working when my kids get home from school, even though, you know, I could spend another 2 or 3 hours. So I just think about, you know, in a given situation, is this the best thing that I could be doing with my time? And one of my favorite quotes is, never let a goal to be accomplished become more important than a person to be loved. A lot of times I'm so busy doing stuff that I wonder, you know, I should spend some time with my family. So, I mean, I think that that one's completely based on your own value system, and you have to determine what is the most important things? What are the best things in life that deserve your highest attention? And for me, you know, there's a lot of good things in life. And I guess in Jim Collins' book, he talks about how good is actually the enemy of great, that there's a lot of opportunities that come up in life. You know, it's like life will throw a lot of stuff at you, and most of it, you know, some of it's pretty good, but most of it you should actually say no to. You know, people who go the furthest, people that become the greatest, they distinguish the difference between the best, you know, and then just the average good. And they say no to lots of good. Sometimes even life, you know, I mean, sometimes there's once in a lifetime opportunities that pop up. But if they don't align with where you're trying to go, if they don't align with your highest values, then they're just a distraction. And I think you got to be able to distinguish that. You know, lots of good stuff pops up for me all the time. People ask me to, help them in their startup, or I guess people will come to you and ask you for their help all the time, or to join projects, or and you just have to be able to say, this is something good, but it's just not the best thing for me. And I guess that's where I determine it. It's really a value system.
Yeah, and it's hard to say no if you don't have something else really hot going on. And it's easy to be like, oh, sure.
And it's like, if you do that enough, you'll get in the habit of it.
Right. And then you're all of a sudden your schedule fills up, and then you can't say yes to the really great stuff when it comes because you've already overcommitted. So tell me, do you know how to make cheese? I see these goat videos. Tell
Oh
us
my
about
goodness. Oh
you're busted. Tell us about what that year was all about.
my gosh. Okay, I did not expect this, but that makes it even more fun. Okay.
I'll include on the show notes. This is a little surprise. So on the show notes, I'll try to embed the video that your wife made. This looks like a lot of hard work, but also probably one of those life experiences you couldn't get any other way.
Okay. So me and my wife, we both graduated from our undergrads in this, I guess, April of 2013. And she's way more of an adventurer than me. She's, I mean, we've been out of the country several times together, but she's kind of grown up in a culture of travel. And anyways, she's more into the kind of travel, not where you go for like a week, but more where you go for a few months, you live with the natives and actually experience the culture. And there's a lot of programs that allow you to do that cheap. We were fresh out of college. We didn't have very much money. But there's a program called WOOF. It's an acronym for Worldwide Organization of Organic Farming. And you can do it anywhere in the world. There's lots of different programs like it. But with WOOF, you sign up for a country. And she really wanted to go to Ireland. I was just kind of going along for the ride, honestly. And she wanted to live on a few different farms. And so we lived on a goat farm for a month, and then we lived on a bed and breakfast where we kind of helped beautify the gardens. But so we lived on this goat farm, and he was a blind goat farmer, lived down on this small island at the southern tip of Ireland. It's like a 2 mile by 2 mile little island. There's no stores on it. There's a ferry that comes back and forth every day and brings the people's groceries. And yeah, we worked on the farm. We basically is all we did was we fed the goats in the morning, we milked them, we learned how to turn the milk into cheese, and at the end of the day, we let them graze all day, and we ended up just listening to audiobooks and just hanging out and looking at the beautiful landscapes and going for runs and stuff, and then at the end of the day, we'd just bring the goats in and put them away and do the same over again. And we did that for a month, and then we went to a different farm for a month and just backpacked around. And so yeah, I know how to milk the goats. My wife knows how to make the cheese.
Wow. Yeah, that looked really neat. I know someone who went to South Africa and went and did the same sort of thing. And so I was familiar with the program, but it was cute to see all the goats and see her video and stuff. So I had to ask you about it.
That is funny. Yeah, well, I'm glad I stuck that link on there, because what's so funny is that so many people will send her the most funny comments on that YouTube video, because it's on her YouTube channel, and like she's like, oh my goodness, all these goofy people from your blog keep coming and watching this video of us.
It sucks you right in. You're like, what? Goats? Oh, this is fun. Where could people find you to read your articles and to get your book?
Yeah, so my website's just benjaminhardy.com. It's my name. It's, just spelled out BenjaminHardy.com. And my Slipstream Time Hacking book, I just give away for people who subscribe to the blog. And I put all my articles just right there on my website. I write a lot at different places like Medium and stuff like that. But yeah, that's pretty much all you need to know to get in contact with me, is benjaminhardy.com.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, and I will be following you, and maybe you can come back again sometime and we can chat again. This was a lot of fun for me.
I would love to keep chatting with you, Lisa. Thank you for the opportunity. Seriously, this was a lot of fun.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.